Hi there. This is Dr. O, the host of Race, Health, and Happiness. Welcome to our special new series, RHH on Campus, where we are showcasing the talents of our student interns. We have a special three-part series on COVID-19 hosted by TMU student Xavier Oshinowo. He is interviewing members of the Black Scientist Task Force on Vaccine Equity. Each of these episodes focuses on one of three topics, which are the impact of COVID-19 in Black communities, community distrust, and the condition known as long COVID. Let's take a listen.
Hi, my name is Xavier Oshinowo, and in this episode of RHH on Campus, I speak to Selina Caesar Chavan, who served as a former Member of Parliament with the Government of Canada, representing the town of Whitby from 2015 to 2019. She currently is the Senior Advisor of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusivity Initiatives and Adjunct Lecturer at Queen's University. In addition, she is a renowned research consultant that has worked on basic clinical and epidemiological research studies. Selina Caesar Chavan is another member of the Black Scientist Task Force on Vaccine Equity, a multidisciplinary team of Black experts created to share information about COVID-19 and vaccines with the Black Toronto communities and address their concerns. Today, I have the privilege to speak with Selina about community distrust. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Xavier. Looking forward to this discussion.
I appreciate you coming. Why do Black communities have such mistrust for health institutions? How does this mistrust impact the likelihood of members of Black communities seeking health services?
So that's a good question because we know there's a long history of mistrust. Marion Sims, with a gynecologist who used enslaved Black women to do gynecological surgical applications without anesthetic. Tuskegee, we do understand that there's a history of sterilization when it comes to Black women. And we see even now, so it's not even a historical thing. We see now the outcomes of a system that was built on racist practices. You know, you have Dr. Cartwright talking about, you know, how are justifying the inferiority of Black people based on the size and the volume of their skulls. So there is a definite history, but it's not just the history that exists. It is how the history and the legacy of those racist practices, policies, legislation, whatever, has manifested itself today. So if you have a system that is built on a racist practice, you have a system that's built on a disease, how then do you expect the fruit of that system to bear healthy fruit for people that have been marginalized by it? So how do you expect the fruit to then be nourishing to Black people? And we see it right now with, you know, the high rates of almost three times more death and mortality for a Black woman who go in and, you know, for maternal issues. So mistrust is not unfounded. It has a legacy, it has very deep roots, and it has present day consequences. And so when we think about, you know, when we go for mental health or any kind of health issues, we know that when we present, we're not taken seriously. We are not listened to in the same way. And it's irrespective of class. So I want to be very clear about that. So, you know, we had, I'm going to forget her name, but you, for example, you have Serena Williams. Serena Williams goes to a hospital. She says, like, look, something's happening to me. Oh my God, something's happened to me. Can you help me out? And her doctor says, you know, just leaves her talking. And she actually said, you know, I'm dying here. I'm dying. And these people are not even listening to me. Then you have Dr. Suzanne Moore, who was in so much pain with COVID, her doctor made her feel like she was a drug addict and died. So you know, we have these issues that even in present day 2021, Indiana University Hospital, you could have a physician, a Black female physician, die talking to her doctor and saying, no, I'm a physician. I'm not drug addict. I'm not asking for narcotics. I'm in pain. I have COVID. And they dismiss her and she dies. And then we have Joyce Echevon here in Canada. Again, there is this legacy of, it's not that we mistrust. There hasn't been trust built into the system. So it's not on us to mistrust. There was no trust in the first place. So you're expecting something of a community that was never there to begin with.
All right. So you give a lot of examples about black females that have had this mistrust. Do you see that more common with females than you do with men? Or is it, you know, a general consensus that it's just the mistrust is just poor all around?
So, you know, I am a black female, so I tend to follow what is happening with black females with a lot more urgency. I don't feel that I am able to talk with as much examples when it comes to black males, although I'm sure that just based on the inference of, or the fact that we have a number of different intersecting identities that we have to deal with that are met with sexism and met with racism and met with classism or ableism or any kind of homophobia or xenophobia, that intersecting component of gender, race, class tends to disproportionately move black women out of the center and further into the margins. So I will focus my conversations there. Because once we fix that problem, then every other problem down the road gets addressed.
Exactly. Exactly. And I actually didn't know that about Serena Williams. Because I haven't played in a while, but I've been playing tennis my whole life at a highly competitive level. And my mom is the biggest Williams sister fan ever. So I did not know that it was that bad. And this was
in 2017 when she was giving birth to her daughter. And you know, it's interesting. Like, and I just want to read a quote from her from a USA Today article. She said, you know, they were trying to talk to me and all I could think was, I'm dying. Oh my God. Being heard and appropriately treated was the difference between life and death for me. Now, like even in Serena Williams's case, it's the difference of life and death.
Yeah.
What happens to those who do not have the power, the privilege, the class status that Serena Williams has? And this is why black women are nearly three times more likely to die after childbirth than their white counterparts, because oftentimes that intersection of class plays a huge role in their outcome.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I see. Yeah, it's not great. It's not great. And so, yeah, like you're saying, this historical mistrust has definitely impacted, like there's a big hesitancy for people to get the vaccine now in the black communities because of mistrust.
Well, you see, again, we're misappropriating the word to us. Like, we do not have mistrust. The system has never given us the ability to trust it.
So now
you're asking us to take the vaccine. And I want to speak to people very candidly here. I do believe that people should get the vaccine. Of course, I worked for a very long time in clinical trials. I understand the process. Mm-hmm. What I am saying is that I understand, conspiracy theories aside, vaccines aside, what I understand is people's general feelings about a system that was never built with the capacity to trust it in the first place.
So it's not a mistrust. It's more of a distrust.
Well, you can call it what we want. The system was never built for us to trust it. So how are you asking us to do that?
Exactly. Right. I know. I'm saying, yeah, I know. I just want to create a vocab word.
Yeah, you know what? And I just think that there's a challenge for me when we identify the person as the problem instead of the system. We have a stultifying system, whether we're talking about health or education or justice or housing or whatever, that continuously try to crush the souls, if not the lives, of people of African descent in this country and beyond. And so we need to actually label the systems themselves and not the people as being mistrusting. Label the system as a stultifying system, as a system that never generated trust, as a system that is built on white supremacy, capitalism, patriarchy, colonialism, etc.
Mm-hmm. And has the system made any difference at all? Like, the way you're laughing, it doesn't sound like it's going to be good. But for example, since the pandemic, has there been a slight change?
So let me tell you one good thing about the system. Okay. The system is working exactly as it should. Exactly as it should. Whether it's education, whether it's health, it doesn't matter. The system is working as it should. If the system is designed and rooted to ensure the dehumanization of Black and Indigenous people in particular, it will work to do so until those that are within the system go back in and dig out the disease that is causing the ill fruit. At the end, then it won't change. And it's not just about changing people, it's changing the policies, the practices, the actual systems itself that have led to this legacy. So even post-pandemic, or I don't think we're in post-pandemic, I do not want to say that, but even when we think about at the height of the pandemic, how in Toronto, which has 52% people of color at the height of the pandemic, almost 80% of the burden of COVID-19 was falling on 52% of the population. That was disproportionately falling on 52% of the population. The Black community, 9% of the population, at its height, almost 30% of the burden of COVID-19 falling on Black communities. Now, when you think about that, maybe people will say, oh my God, well, COVID-19 is not racist. No, it's not. But the systems that impact our social determinants of health, our education, our justice, our housing, our health, everything else is built on those practices. So unless we use this moment and we seize this moment to change some of those other structures, we are not going to see a positive return for people of African descent who were continued to hospitalized more, who could not afford to take a day off because they couldn't be precarious with their money, who died more, who had more social impact. And so I think one of the legacies of this pandemic, especially for our communities in these Western paradigms, will be to see if those social determinants of health change or not.
Right. And now I know there's been a recent $45 billion contribution to healthcare in Canada from the Canadian government. Do you think that will really help the Black community? And if so, how could it?
So those are part of a regular health transfer, right? That goes to the province. And when you think about the province of Ontario, so the federal government gives $45 billion. The provinces kick up dust about not wanting to sign. It doesn't make any sense. And then that money is then allocated to health services from the province. And then obviously trickles down to the city. What we could see is even in the last budget issued by the city of Toronto, $48 million to police services and programs and services.
Yes. 48 to police?
48 million. Wow. And the programs and services that support those social determinants of health that I was speaking about got zero increase in their budget. So I think at the end of the day, you could follow the money, but you can't follow the big chunk. You have to follow it all the way to the end. And then you also have to follow. So when the federal government in 2018 gave $9 million to Black communities for mental health services, it was $9 million over 3 to 5 years. Like, I'm sorry, it's not funny, but it actually is funny. The entire budget was $50 million for Black communities. The entire thing. $9 million of it was for mental health.
Right.
Over 5 years. When you actually divide that up, so there's 1.3 million Black people in Canada. Like, do the math. That means each of us gets, like, what, $20? You have to actually tell them to take their money and stick it. And to be honest, and look, we are a G7 country. If I'm not able to critique the government and their doling out of money, 2018 was the first time Black communities was ever mentioned in a federal budget, and you give us $50 million, which is a joke, essentially saying this is what $50 million is for a federal government of a G7 country. If we were to take $50 million in a suitcase and walk down the front steps of Parliament Hill, we trip and we fall, and that $50 million flies away, they will not even notice that it's gone. It's not even a rounding error. That's what we're worth. So don't talk to me about a $45 billion transfer. Talk to me when that money goes into the hands of people who are able to make impact in a sustainable way to build capacity around the social determinants of health that impact Black and Indigenous people. Then we could have a conversation. Until then, I'm just going to laugh.
Right. Yeah, it does. It's not helping. It's not helping at all. It does not sound like they know.
They're not being intentional. They know exactly what they're doing. Again, the system is working as it should. Right.
Right, and it's not. Yeah. Though if that's how it should, if it should be, you know, quotations on that one for those at home, then there's clearly something wrong. 100%. There's clearly an issue there. And now, what would you, and if you were in your shoes, what would you do?
So what these organizations need, and these are organizations that honestly, they work on shoestring budgets and they do amazing work. What they need is predictable, sustainable funding that could help them scale up and build capacity. Now, most of the time when money is given in terms of funding, they are given specifically for services or for new programs, but you're never able to hire the person that is required in the office. So the organization stays as like, you know, a 2 to 9 person operation and never has the capacity to scale up, meaning get a new building, get new infrastructure, get new supplies, hire consultants to build out programs or to do their programs differently, get the technology that is needed. So again, we're even when we are doling out this money and people are like, oh my God, thank you for $50 million. It's so great. And I'm like, are you nuts? Are you mad? Like, even with that $50 million, there is no capacity building, meaning I'm going to see you in a state of starvation and give you enough money so that you stay in a state of starvation. Make it make sense to me.
Some people don't have the income to be able to afford certain things.
And 100%.
If you're saying only getting $20, that's literally nothing. that's barely literally any. Nothing. That's nothing.
That's literally
it's literally nothing. Nothing. They cannot afford any medical attention if needed, or, you know, it's just, it's not feasible for so many people. And it hurts to see that, you know, people are in this state and that, you know, the government is doing the bare minimum.
You call it bare minimum. I call it nothing. But here we are. One thing you got to know about me, Javier, I'm not going to play nice when it comes to our community.
I don't blame you.
I do not blame you with a sense of like, it's just a deep, profound, there's something that is deep and profound. And if I don't laugh and if I don't challenge these things, I will, like, how long can you just cry about it? You know? How long can you just let it hurt? And I understand my power and my privilege. I totally understand the privilege that I have to call things out. So I'm going to continue to do so because we are dying. This is what the pandemic has taught us. Is that it's not just, oh, they're hurting, or, you know, they feel some microaggressions and they could just, you know, live with it, or my unconscious bias is just bothering them a little bit. People are dying. People are dying. And those people happen to look like me, and I'm tired of them dying.
So has there been progress in addressing health institutional mistrust in Black communities, and what approaches have worked so far?
I think one of the approaches, especially during COVID, was having the Black Scientist Task Force, where our job was not to tell people whether or not to get vaccinated. It was to give information so that people could actually make an informed choice. So after receiving all of this information, they could then choose based on information that is scientific, that is the best that we could give them. They could make a choice as to whether or not they want to get vaccinated or not get vaccinated. We were giving them information. And the panel of scientists that we had, experts that we had, was absolutely phenomenal. And I think what it did was, and we see it again with medicine, especially again, if I go to the maternal Black women's story, is that when Black children or Black moms and babies are treated by Black physicians, the mortality rate increases. When we are given information that is for us, by us, then there tends to be a difference in how we perceive, how we take in that information. And even if we choose to say, no, we don't want to get vaccinated, at least we know that we have been given that information by people who understand the mistrust, understand the legacy of that mistrust, and understand the legacy of the systems that may determine that trust factor and understand how it impacts other social determinants of health. So we weren't just looking at it from a scientific perspective. We were making sure that we were connecting with legal clinics so that people who didn't want to get vaccinated had other options. We also presented to the city of Toronto, to the province, and to the federal government, looking at other social determinants of health, housing, justice, education, et cetera. So it wasn't just about, hey, you need to get vaccinated. It was, here's the information, and then here's all the way that we could use our brilliance to protect you.
Right. And I'd spoken to Dr. Todd in the previous episode, and she mentioned community centers were a big thing. Could you speak about, you know, some of the community centers as well?
Yeah. So it turned into something that was really beautiful, I think, in a time when we were so disconnected. And one of the social parts of how we heal is that connection, right? So when we had community centers or community health clinics, I'm hosting these vaccination drives with food and music and enjoyment. Mm-hmm. It was healing. That's how we heal. We don't heal, you know, by, I don't know, Brene Browning or Sheryl Sandberging leaning in. We heal together.
Right.
We heal as community. We fet, we love, we laugh, we joke, we act the fool. We do that together. And during the pandemic, we didn't have that opportunity.
Yeah, you didn't at all.
Right? Mm-hmm. So it was part of that cultural understanding of the wholeness of us that allowed us to really capitalize, where there were like waiting lists for people going to the CHDs, the community health clinics, to get, you know, vaccinated, or, you know, to buck up with people. I don't know what they were there for, whether they even got vaccinated at the end of the day, but it was an opportunity.
Exactly,
to like,
just to be around other people, you know? Love and, right. And everything. And
remember, we missed funerals, we missed baptisms, we missed all of the stuff that we do.
Yeah.
So... yeah.
Yeah. Well, those are all the questions I have for you. So I really appreciate you coming today. And I thought all the information you gave us was so inspiring, very powerful stuff. And honestly, thank you very much for correcting me personally. So now I know for the future what to share with everybody else. So thank you very much for coming.
You know what? Knowledge is shared and we're always learning. So I'm learning from you just as much as you're learning from me. So that's the way it goes. And I'm proud of you for using this platform, this capacity to share information that may otherwise not get to other people.
Thank
so
you very much.
Congratulations to you, and really proud and thankful for your platform and using your voice.
Thank you. To quickly conclude this episode, I want to talk about the difference between mistrust and distrust. Mistrust is a doubt or skepticism regarding the trustworthiness of a person, but in this case, with race. Distrust, on the other hand, is the belief that the other is untrustworthy. In regard to healthcare, there is no mistrust because there is no doubt that the healthcare system is untrustworthy. Why should we as the Black community trust white healthcare workers when they have not given us any reason to do so? This is the reason why the Black community has a distrust for healthcare. They literally have not in any way, shape, or form given us any reason to share any trust with them. Thank you everyone for tuning in. This was the last episode of the COVID series. We will be back soon with another 3 guests. Stay tuned.